Hey folks, welcome to today's Talky Bit. It's good to be with you. Okay, here we go. And we're just going to get right into this by talking about a famous theologian. Now, had a chance this past week to see a favorite singer-songwriter, Donovan Woods, was in town at the Burt, and very self-deprecating sense of humor, very funny, talking about how good it is to be back on the road, touring again, and how those of them in the band that have kids, their kids were starting to think that they were just always around, you know, and now they could, kids could come to a concert and see, as Donovan was telling the story, see that there's a band and there's lights and there's smoke, and clearly I am a very important Canadian singer, folk singer, I think is the phrase he used. And then he just cracked himself up. He's like, is that even a thing? Like, famous Canadian folk singer, famous theologian is sort of like famous Canadian folk singer. You know, if you're into them, and you know who they are, then you know. And if you don't, you've probably never heard of them. And so this is kind of like that. I'm in the midst of an ongoing conversation with a friend who has been reading Karl Barth. And if you don't know, and you really very well might not, Barth was a Swiss Protestant theologian, lived from the late 1800s to the late 1960s. And he was and is a bit of a towering figure in terms of his influence as a Christian theologian. He was one of those people whose thinking and writing crossed over from the relatively contained circles of his own academic disciplines into the popular culture in ways that even had international reach toward the end of his life and career, despite being a European. He was featured on the cover of Time magazine in April 1962, which is, given the givens, European, theologian, academic, quite remarkable. I mention that as a general background to the bit that I'm about to share with you, because I suspect most of us, even if we've heard of Karl Barth, we've never read him. And I am so no expert, but I am willing to suggest that if you haven't read Karl Barth, this is not the time to start. Don't do it. My own very limited forays into his academic writing have encountered a combination of brilliance and density that's almost impenetrable. At least for my little brain, and judging by just even a quick sort of examination of writing of other people examining his work, other people are still trying to crack the code too. If you're really curious, look him up on Wikipedia. It's a good summary of the high points. But it's not his academic theological writing or his commentaries that my friend has been reading and that we've been talking about. It's a book of his early sermons. Now, before Barth was ever well known as a theologian, he was a pastor of a small village church. And had he not gone on to the fame that he did, we probably would have no idea what he talked about on any given Sunday morning. But as these things go, we do have a record of many of his sermons, which of course have been and continue to be, you know, parsed and commented on at length. One of the things that really brought Barth to the attention of the world was his refusal to sign, and without modification, because I won't get into it. Anyway, his refusal to sign without modification something called the Oath of Loyalty to Adolf Hitler. And for that refusal, Barth was deported from Germany, where he was teaching, in 1935. Now, lots of Christian academics and clergy did sign that oath. So, as you can perhaps imagine, Barth wasn't winning any popularity points on his home turf by taking that particular stand. The story has more than a couple of overtones that resonate with the current news coverage, for example, of the shoving match between the Pope and the head of the Russian Orthodox Church and their relative positions regarding the Russian invasion of the Ukraine. In any case, the book that my friend's been reading is a collection of some of Barth's sermons, and in particular, sermons that were preached between 1918 and 1922. Now, the history buffs in our midst will realize that this is the period that followed World War I, during which the pandemic took place, and during which time things were ramping up toward World War II. A few too many parallels for comfort, perhaps, but it does lend a different sort of possible interest to this quote from one of those sermons. So, this is from an April sermon 105 years ago. As spring will presently draw us out of our kitchens and living rooms into the gardens, fields, and woods, where the warm sun will give us a feeling of wellness, So also, the loving God now calls us out of all the houses of our opinions and thoughts and prejudices, our cares, sadness, and anger. So the loving God now draws us down from the high horse of our points of view and converts these self-formed ideas of ours, like one might turn an old coat inside out and hang it to let it air. So the loving God leads us beyond our narrow doorways into the street, so that we can see the heavens and each face the other. Now, I personally don't see eye to eye with Bart on any number of things, and I have absolutely no doubt that he would take quite crisp exception, I expect, to what I'm about to suggest, which is that it's important in regarding a quote like that from the vantage point of 21st century pluralism to use interchangeably words and ideas like God, Spirit, love, when speaking of whatever we might think of as more or other than ourselves, what Bart in that quote calls the loving God. However, with that in mind, and as Bart is spinning in his grave, perhaps, that quote, I think, sets a pretty high bar for whatever we might consider greater than ourselves. I think it raises a rather compelling question, which might be something like, what is there in my life that has the power to call me out of the house of my own opinions, thoughts, and prejudices, out of my own narrow doorways and into the street so that I can glimpse what is beyond me and also face my fellow human beings? What is there in my life that has that kind of power? Now, no matter how we might think or speak of what is beyond us, whether we personify the divine or not, for instance, there is something about what Bart is suggesting here that seems essential. And yes, I'm using essential on purpose. I'm using essential like, do I have food and shelter? Am I safe? Are those I love cared for? We are surrounded daily by the evidence that our species has a deep drive to give shape to what mystifies us, what speaks to us on the level of spirit. It's not an inclination limited by culture or geography or race or ethnicity. It is one of the things that makes us human. In this series that we're in, on seeing religions in 3D, one of my guiding notions is that we, humans, are motivated intrinsically as well as extrinsically to do what we can to approach what is spiritual. And one of the main pieces of evidence for this, if we want to think in terms of evidence, is the way we make religions. I find this an interesting topic to explore in our setting because I know that this is a community in which we have a quite varied collection of relationships with religion. I've mentioned this before, but it's a burr in my mental socks. The words of Ray Bernier. Ray's been a part of this community for several years. Long enough to be around a few years ago when we did this word cloud. I was writing about this word cloud, and I wrote a couple of years ago, and then I thought this is way more than a couple of years ago, but those 2 years of pandemic feel like time misbehaved in there. But anyway, within the last few years, we did this thing together one morning where we made a word cloud, and the idea was to come up with words or short phrases that sort of defined our experience of or our relationship with the table. And Ray said something like, the table is about as much religion as I can stand, which amuses me to this day, both just as a statement all on its own, and also as Ray unpacked it, the realization that he didn't mean something negative by that. It could be that. It could be like, this is as much as I can tolerate. But also, I want to take something in, and this framework for it is the way I can do it, the way I can take it in. Some of us, maybe most of us, in this community have kind of a sliding scale for religiosity. A bit of it, we can work with that. Too much, we're out of there. Kind of, you know, I like them, but sometimes they get too religious. You know, that kind of a thought or a experience of another person or perhaps a community. If we can, I think it might be helpful to have some of that range of experiences and perspectives in mind as I offer these next observations about religion. And also, keep in mind that what we're doing in this series is sort of circling religions. We're sort of taking a tour around some of what religions have in common that points toward what we have in common as humans when it comes to making religions, considering their relative merits and shortcomings, and maybe even, you know, participating in them on occasion. And you might recall that in part one of the series, we considered that idea that religions are cultural linguistic constructs and human products. They're things we make. And also that they can be thought of as responses to that which is spirit or that which is sacred. And whenever I use that word sacred, and we're going to bump into it again in this series, what I have in mind is that Wendell Berry couplet that I mentioned right off the top of the series. There are no unsacred places. There are only sacred places and desecrated places. Whatever we call it, if we're even taking the time to be present to an exploration like this one, the odds are that we're open to the notion or have experienced something that says there's more to life than meets the eye, and I want my life to include deliberate engagement with that more. All to say, religions are, of course, not the only way to do that, but they are one way we humans seem to keep attempting to do that. And worth examining in that light, even if we have all sorts of legitimate reasons for being leery or dismissive about the category of religion. So, continuing in the sorts of themes that we talked about in part one, a couple more ideas to explore. So if we can think of religions as cultural linguistic constructs, human products, and that which we make as a response to that which is spirit or sacred, we could also think of them as wisdom traditions. Wisdom, as you probably know if you've been around this community for a while, is a favorite category of mine. Not because I think myself wise. In fact, it would be foolish to think oneself wise. It's an interesting conundrum in itself. But because I'm so intrigued by the work of wisdom in history. Wisdom, whether we encounter it in the realm of religion or of philosophy, sort of its two predominant homes, wisdom is concerned with questions like, how shall I live? What is life about? I still carry around in my memory the conscious awareness of this framework of what's the nature of the world I'm in, what's wrong with the world I'm in, what might be the redress of what is wrong that I was taught as an undergraduate studying in a religious setting. I now take exception to some of the ways I was taught to apply that framework, not the least of which is the way it was used to set up a particular set of religiously exclusive answers, but I also still find it useful as a framework when it comes to approaching thinking about big problems. Religions operate in this terrain. They are concerned with addressing this question, how shall we live? What constitutes a good life for us, both as individuals and as a collective? Those questions. So it's not that hard to see that this is a core human question. So it's not an exclusively religious question at all. There are lots of irreligious and our-religious folks that are looking for the answer to that question as well. So again, not exclusive. Perhaps one of the things that many religions have in common is that they make this search, this probing of these questions, explicit. They unapologetically say, we're on about this. And we might have been exposed to religions in ways that were very culturally insistent, as institutions that spent a lot of time and energy on saying, here are the moral or behavioral answers to those questions. Live like this. Don't smoke, don't dance, don't drink, don't chew, and don't hang around with girls that do. Oh, yes, there's so many things that are problematic about that. Nobody ever had the nerve to put it on a t-shirt and wear it to class in my undergraduate setting, but obviously I can still remember, I didn't have to look up, I can still remember that piece of religious code from my young adult years. The longer I live with that little memory, the more I suspect that chew, as in tobacco, that chew got put in there not because it was a common practice in the heartland of Saskatchewan, where I learned this, but because the collective religious repression about human sexuality in that setting was so powerful that it just denied the use of the obvious rhyming euphemism for having sex. Also, don't get me started on the patriarchal framework that this saying assumes. There's just so much about it that's just yikes. But it does rather capture, in a bumper stickery kind of way, in a, you know, in a tweet length kind of way, this code idea that one of the things that religion often does is take these huge questions, how shall we live? What's the right way to live? And answer them with that kind of pithiness, that kind of directness, that kind of insistence that there is an answer, a singular answer that expresses rightness. And here it is. Don't smoke, don't, etc., right? Here's the contrast. That's not what I'm talking about when I talk about wisdom traditions. In case you missed it, I'm not suggesting that that little saying that I just rattled off represents a legitimate chunk of the wisdom tradition. Religions are collections, among other things, and they are often collections that are thousands of years old of disclosures about this intersection of life and reality. And we've talked a fair bit in the last few months about the idea that the ultimate thing that is not us, we could legitimately name reality, the thing that doesn't go away whether we believe in it or not. Wisdom traditions, often gathered by religions, are collections of disclosures about that intersection. What happens when life hits reality? How do you live there? And they are, religions that is, or at least they can be, treasure troves of human deliberation about how to live well. Also, pretty great story collections about how not to live well, which are instructive, aren't they? They can be collections of lessons learned about how to live with skill and with kindness, with care for one another, with substantial and enduring human relationships, and so on. And also, of course, the negative corollaries, the contravening sort of ways of living that go with all of that. The story in the Hebrew tradition that, of course, flows over into the Christian tradition in many ways around this story is the story of David, of the king, David, who, I mean, by any description, morally, on a good day, a scoundrel, on a bad day, murderer, held up as this shining example of someone with the same sort of heart that the divine has, a man after God's own heart. Well, interesting story. When you think about it in terms of the possibility of learning how to live well, how to be wise, because that's what wisdom is, a skill for living, and you think about that story, there's plenty of things to learn. They don't all necessarily suggest that David was some kind of paragon of virtue, do they? Of course, if we can't learn from our mistakes, we're in trouble. The trick, if you will, is to examine the contents of that treasure trove with its human origins clearly in view, as well as its incompleteness clearly in view. We're not done exploring the big questions, and religions might be getting, to use one of my grandfather's great phrases, religions might be getting too big for their britches if they present their own answers as the final or only word. I don't think a religion can do that and also simultaneously, or at least not do it well or graciously, and also simultaneously acknowledge its deeply cultural context. Cultures move, they're fluid, they change, they evolve, and for a religion to come along and say, this is how humans should live, full stop, is to kind of ignore the fact that they're cultural entities. And of course, not everyone believes that they are. So there's a point of divergence right there. Another thought. Religions, when they are doing what they should, are a means of transformation. And when I say means, I'm thinking in very practical terms. Religions tend to have a practical purpose. And at its heart, that purpose is most often transformation. Not just psychological transformation, as important as that is. Religions tend to be on about spiritual transformation, about the transformation of the self at the deepest, most mysterious levels. And we might encounter this in the language of, for example, movement away from an old way of being to a new way of being, or away from an old identity to a new identity. And don't most of us, at least sometimes, feel the need for that kind of movement in our lives? However, we don't have to look very far from home to see the downside of this. It's one lens through which we could view the motivation for, I couldn't figure out what to call the, I mean, for the residential schools. I was going to call it an enterprise, and I was just like, no, there's no good word for that particular piece of history. And I'm not playing fast and loose with language here when I say that those schools said they existed to transform people, to move people from an old identity to a new identity. So, if we look at that idea of moving from one identity to another through that lens, it's not very hard to see how, at that intersection of religion and transformation, things can go horrendously awry. And one way to reflect on that, in light of considering religions in a fuller, more 3D kind of way, is to observe that across religious traditions over time, so you kind of have to really back the camera up and have a wide view to see this, but if you do, one of the things we can see is that in religious traditions over time, the goal of spiritual transformation is compassion. The goal of spiritual transformation is that we as humans would become more compassionate beings. In hindsight, it seems like even a cursory application of that observation would have revealed that a program like residential schools was, from its inception, from its basis, not only flawed, but just flat out wrong. It was, if we want to use good and evil language, it was evil. Violence is not the ground in which compassion grows. Erasure is not the ground in which compassion grows. Vertical power-oriented exclusivity around ideas, even around answers to these kinds of big questions like how shall we live that we've been talking about this morning, is not the ground, not the tilled, fresh, potential-filled, nutrient-dense ground in which compassion grows. Love is that ground. Yes, that was a heavy sigh. You know, I had one more idea to explore today, but I'm going to leave it right there instead. The story of colonization and its relationship to religion is a deeply troubling one. And it's one of the most obvious reasons I can think of for rejecting religion out of hand, at least in this moment in history. And in this particular case, for rejecting out of hand the Christian religion, and for wanting to have nothing to do with anything that even has an echo of that. One of the things, there's a couple of things I find interesting about that intersection, and really complex. I've touched on this one before, but just very briefly. I keep meeting Indigenous folks who are Christian, and also very aware of and engaged in their traditional practices. That's a very interesting intersection to me. And one that I've really wrestled with trying to understand. In some cases, at least, when I've learned those people's personal stories, they have included experiences of encounter with a Christian person of European or settler origin who was loving, who didn't get the memo about erasure, or who just got it and said no, you know? That who actually thought that the tradition that they were in was about love. And if the tradition that they were in was about transforming people spiritually, it was about transforming us so we would be more compassionate, not just in one cultural direction, but that we would be more compassionate to one another. And so in their relationships, as people with settler heritage, with people of indigenous identity and heritage, what they brought to those relationships was love and compassion. And it was transformative. And so there is this generation of indigenous folks for whom their indigeneity and those traditions and practices, those sacred truths are deeply important, transformative, and they live alongside their Christian experience. They live intertwined with their Christian experience. Unimaginable to the people, many of the people that trained me, I think. Not all, perhaps, but in vast majority. So that's kind of intriguing, isn't it? Another thing that I find interesting is, in sort of an ongoing way, is that in response to rejecting one religion or turning away from it because of its misdeeds and failings, we often turn toward another. And if we don't turn toward another religion in the sense of a particular name, tradition, or practice, we often go looking for something with those same characteristics that we've been talking about. We go looking for something that taps into deeper, wider wisdom, something that is transformative, something that helps us connect with one another. I put those two illustrations back to back because they both feel to me like they touch on an apparent conundrum, or at least something that's mysterious, a little bit baffling. So this is where I'm going to leave that. As we continue to explore what we believe, we could just hit an intersection like that and go, no, this is a swamp. I don't know which way to go. I need a hint at some direction. And I think there might be some hints at a direction to move when we come to those kind of places in that question that we considered earlier. A question for personal reflection, a question for conversation with trusted people in our lives. The question again is this: what is there in my life that has the power to call me out of the house of my own opinions, thoughts, and prejudices, out of my own narrow doorways and into the street, so that I can glimpse what is beyond me and also face my fellow human beings? It seems to me that it's also worth remembering, as Karl Barth suggested 100 years ago, from within the wisdom tradition that is Christian thought, that spring is a powerful metaphor for transformation. Yes. Maybe the best thing we can do, if we are able, is take a few minutes and take that idea out for a walk. Open mind, open heart, engaged body. What does the mystery have to say to me? What does that which is not me, that which is more, that which is other, have to say to me about what might have the power to call me out of the house of my own opinions, thoughts, and prejudices, out of my own narrow doorways and into the street, so that I can glimpse what is beyond me and also face my fellow human beings? And then be still and listen. All right. Peace, everybody. Enough talking. Talking about listening. Enough talking. Gonna leave it there. Good to be with you.